This is a Doxcast, not an Argon Soxcast, or a Bendis and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry. This is a Doxcast. It's a nerdy Toxcast. Discuss a Moxcast with Rich Early and friends.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another stuffed episode of the Doxcast. I am your co-host, Josh Trumbo, and with me, as always, is the mousy Rich Early. Rich, how are you doing this podcast?
I thought you were going to go nice. I see what you did there. I thought you were going to go for Fable.
I was going to make you stuffed, but then I thought
that's too accurate, so too on point. I'm great, Josh, and we got a great episode of the Doxcast today. So just for some housekeeping, we record the Doxcast about once a month live on Twitch, and then we post episodes every Monday morning, except for when you and I oversleep. But you know, generally that's the plan. Yeah.
Don't let them peek behind the curtain.
All right, fine. And tonight we've got a great guest with us, Josh.
Yes, we do. We have Jerry Hawthorne joining us, a board game designer of a number of great titles. Probably two of the most famous ones would be Mice and Mystics and the fairly new Stuffed Fables joining us. Hello, Jerry.
Hello.
Oh, he wasn't kidding. He's not going to carry us.
I can do a little dance.
I think
I know the robot.
Yeah.
Perfect.
One word answers. Josh, you have a lot of questions. And we've got a copy of Stuffed Fables on camera. Both Josh and I own the game and have played it, and we didn't.
Neither
bring
of us
our
brought
open
our copies.
Because
we were professionals.
Yeah. Yeah, we've done this before, I swear. So, Jerry, where are you tonight? You're live with us on Skype, but where are you coming to us from?
I am from Dallas, Texas right now. Correctly, I'm from Addison, Texas right now, so where the Plaid Hat headquarters are.
Oh, cool. Okay. Excellent. So, yeah, and just to talk about Stuffed Fables for a second, this is an awesome game. Like, seriously, yeah. Josh, like, this game is great.
I've already warned Jerry that my kids are absolutely obsessed with it, and so I'm going to ask him a lot of questions that he will either not have the answers to or not be able to tell us the answers to. So...
hopefully I'll be able to help you out.
And I mean, like, the idea for this game too has got to be like easily expandable, right? Like, would you do another book? Would you add monsters? Like what's rolling through your brain already for this game?
Well, if I was to do an expansion for it, I would probably do another book and maybe a couple more figures. And you know, just some new adventures. Maybe the little girl has a younger brother that comes along or something.
Oh.
And we get to see things from a different angle, maybe.
Who did and so I'm kind of a novice on this stuff, so if everybody knows all this stuff already, I apologize. But like, so who did all the writing for the book? Did you do everything? How did this thing come together?
Okay, so the way that the writing works is I am a game designer, inventor, and developer, and so I wrote the story, and I wrote all the scenes and all of the game mechanics that go along with it, and I developed the mechanics and everything. But I'm a pretty, I mean, I can weave a great story, you know, I can tell a great story, but my prose is not very good, to be honest with you. And we have a guy that I've been working with that I've known for a decade, and we work closely together, and he is really good at like making my words sound a lot better. And so what he does is he comes in and he rewrites all my writing and makes it all sound like a professional writer rather than like the crappy writer that I am. Is that interesting?
Yep.
It's a pretty good system.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm proud of myself because I can come up with some really cool story ideas, and I can get those story arcs going, and I can get the tempo of the story and everything. I can get all that done, but you know, it's my writing's fairly crude.
Josh will without a doubt ask most of the questions here, but like one of the big things in games right now is when you can marry flavor together with mechanics, that's when you've got a home run. And I remember like an example for me is when I first played the Marvel Legendary game from Ultra Pro. Great game. I mean, I love the game system. I own a bunch of them. But the thing is, it was very mechanical. You know, like, yeah, it had pictures of Marvel characters on it, but it was a very mechanical game system. And so like, But when I pick up a game like Stuffed Fables, it's so much more successful because, like, I feel the story and I feel the mechanics and I just feel them working together. So, like, how important, you know, when you were designing, how much was about that? How much was trying to get those two things to fit together?
Well, I mean, I'm, you know me, I'm like, I'm all about the story, right? So it's incredibly important to me. In fact, I don't think that I could actually, I don't really think that I can separate the two. I can't really design games. Well, I can, but I mean, I can't really design games that I want to play unless they have some sort of story involved. It's just the kind of person, the kind of gamer I am. And I have a little story about this, if you don't mind me saying.
Oh, no, that's why you're on.
Okay, so what the reason that you're finding that a lot, there's a big trend for story in games right now, is that gaming has grown beyond its original borders. It's grown beyond its borders. And as our demographic has grown, we're in this great, you know, explosive age of board games. We are taking on, hopefully, you know, we're taking on a lot more new gamers. And we're evolving board gaming into an entertainment industry. And what they're discovering is that if you want, in this marketplace, it's like full of games. If you want to leave a lasting impression on the consumer, you need to leave an indelible impact on their memory. And nothing does that better than stories. And I always tell this little story about what happened to me and the aha moment that I had when I was on an airplane headed out to a meeting at the Hasbro headquarters out on the East Coast. I was on an airplane and I was wedged between these two other passengers. And one was playing a Sudoku puzzle and the other one was reading a book, and my phone ran out of battery charge. So I was just left to sit there and do nothing. And so before the plane landed, I noticed that the person on my right finished up their Sudoku puzzle and they folded it up and put it back in their bag. And the person on my left, finished her book. She was on the last few pages of her book, and she finished her book and she tilted her head back and tears like welled up in her eyes, and she just took a big deep breath, and I couldn't help but notice, and I said, "Good book, huh?" And she's like, "Oh, you don't even know." And she was just obviously moved. And the thought occurred to me that if I was to find those two people a year later and I asked them if they remembered, you know, if that person remembered that Sudoku puzzle that they played on this airline flight number 281 or whatever, they probably wouldn't remember that Sudoku puzzle. It probably didn't stick out in their memory beyond any other Sudoku puzzle. Sudoku is a great experience. It's a wonderful exercise for the brain, but it won't leave an indelible impact on your memory the way a book does, because that other passenger would totally remember that book.
Right.
So that's what we're doing with stories. You can have board games that have elegant mechanics and are fun to play and are great exercises for the brain and bring people together and do everything that we love about games. But you might not remember an individual experience of playing that game. For instance, if you were to play Splendor, which is an award-winning, wonderful, fantastic game, mm-hmm. if you were to play Splendor one time, you would remember that. But if you played the Splendor 10 times, you're not going to remember, you know, the individual experiences. But if you play through a game that has a lot of story, especially a story that like grows with a continuing narrative and stuff like that, you're going to remember all of those little experiences. I remember playing through every chapter, every scenario in the HeroQuest quest book, you know, every quest that I remember all of them distinctly. I remember the experiences that I had with my fellow players, people I might not even know to this day. I still remember those experiences we had together. So
That's awesome, and I really am just going to let Josh ask the questions. But so how important is it then that how does replayability come into that? Sometimes with some of these, I don't necessarily know this is the case with Stuffed Fables. I haven't played enough of it yet, right? But when they're story based, it feels more like I'm going to play it once versus play it a bunch of times. And I know there's a lot of dynamics to this game, so you're probably going to answer that a lot, and that's great. But, you know, like versus Dominion, where I can sit down and just play Dominion over and over and over and over again or something like that. Does that make sense?
It makes plenty of sense. But
Go ahead.
I didn't mean to talk over.
Nope. You're the guest. I'm sorry.
Well, it sounded like one question and then another question tacked on, so I didn't know if I should.
Nope. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, in our industry is big enough that we can have lots of different kinds of gaming experiences. So you can have a Dominion type experience, and that game, if you were to make a game like Dominion, your goal, your end goal would be to create a game that players can play over and over and over and over again. And it's a, and you know, typically it would deliver a certain gaming experience that fits into a certain amount of time. The more, the lower amount of time and the richer the experience, the more frequently people are going to want to play it. Or you can create a game that has a really long play time, like Twilight Imperium, where people might only play it once a year, but it's still, you know, it still delivers a certain kind of experience. My games are kind of like a movie or a book. You may, if you enjoyed it, you may read it again, even though you know what's going to happen. I've played through video games from beginning to end. I've watched movies over and over again. I've seen Star Wars dozens of times. I've seen Children of Men dozens of times. I have favorites that I never get tired of. Those, to me, have replayability. So I hope I'm answering your question adequately.
Absolutely. I guess the last part of that, and my last question before seriously letting Josh take over.
He's never going to let me talk podcast.
I swear. He did all the work to get you. He has all these questions laid up. But no, like how much of that, too, is impacted by the fact that like there are, what, 5,000 games hit the market last year? And so does your game need to just like get into my possession, get played, and be great, but also move over so that, you know, so that I'm getting that next game, you know?
Yeah, dude. I mean, we were having this discussion 2 years ago. We were were literally sitting around the office talking about games as a consumption. Like, okay, why are we trying to make games like story-based games that are going to stretch over the course of a person's life of playing it for a couple of years? I mean, realistically, you know, people want that entertainment, but they might not necessarily want it to like be their only entertainment for a long time, especially with gamers. There's always something new coming along, right? They're going to make, you only have a finite amount of time. You don't have a finite amount of games, but you only have a finite amount of time and money. You're not going to continue to purchase games and then not play them. If you do, you're going to get what they call consumer exhaustion. You're going to get tired of buying stuff, right? So we almost want the games to be consumed and then let players put it on the secondary market or something like that. Or if it's an heirloom type game like Mice and Mystics, they might put it on their shelves and save it for playing with their grandchildren or something. But I want players to play through the experience. I don't want them to get exhausted halfway through or whatever. Does that make sense?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Josh, all you.
Okay. No, this is all really good stuff so far.
And that's the thing, is I could take this thread a long way, but I don't want to do
goodness,
that.
Oh, my goodness.
You could make a whole podcast on this topic because it's very important. I don't think a lot of people are talking about some of this stuff. But, but I know that around our office, we do talk about it. We talk about this stuff because we are trying to anticipate trends. We're seeing the way that the game market has changed. There's an enormous game explosion right now, and to deal with that amount of noise, you have to have something that you deliver that appeals to the end user. Mm-hmm. So if it's like a quick game, quick games, we buy quick games because we can always do those filler games, you know, that's great. You deliver that, right?
I'm like the middle guy, and so I see the same exact thing, right? Like a few years ago, you had all these evergreens, and you just filled your shelf up, and you had Agricola and you know, everything A to Z, right? And it's just totally different. I mean, it's completely different, and it's just sort of fascinating how it's working today versus just a few years ago.
Yes, indeed, and it's been very quick because I've been in the industry for a long time, but before that, I was a gamer. Before gamers were cool, before this was a big deal, right? And what back then, people, I mean, maybe you're as old as me, I don't know, but back then, you might buy maybe two or three games a year, and we would literally make a whole hobby out of one game. That would be the game that we played. We would play it for years. I mean, like I'll use HeroQuest as an example because it's like my favorite game, but it came out in 1989, and I still play it to this day. But back then, I mean, that's all we played. We played it every chance we got, and we played it all the time. And we weren't kids. We were playing a kid's game, but we were in our 20s, and we would play it on Friday nights before going out and partying on the town and stuff. But that's what we would do, is like a primer before going out and partying, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I have memories in high school of getting together to play Lonely Mountain.
I have that. Nice. Lonely Mountain, yes.
I once killed Smog with a lucky Snake Eyes roll one game.
Oh my
god! I lost. I still lost the game, but I got him.
So yeah, we got some old school gamers in the house.
Oh yeah, yeah. But speaking of old school, let's I'm gonna dial it back just a little bit.
Sure.
And let's get to know you a little bit better and kind of how you got into the hobby. Let's talk a little bit about that and how that led to you designing board games.
Okay, sure. How long is this podcast again?
You know,
long as you want.
If it goes too long, we'll always have you back.
So yeah, I mean, you know, I come from a gaming family now, not, you know, not crunchy board games, but we played Canasta and any trivia game that was popular at the time and card games galore. And it was a big family deal where we would all be gathered around the dinner table and, you know, with both parents involved and laughter and, you know, silly antics that would happen. My dad got to laughing one night so hard when we were playing Canasta that his chair broke and he fell on the floor, had the shocked look on his face. These memories are the kinds of things that are indelible, like I said before, indelible on your memory. And they like form young gamers. And I was a kid. I would love to make sure that everybody in this world had the same kind of experiences that I had with my family playing games. But I also had an older brother who was a super brilliant brainiac guy, and he liked to play Starfleet Battles and Squad Leader and Cross of Iron and Crescendo of Doom and all of these old crunchy chit-based, you know, hex and chit games. And he didn't have anybody to play, so he taught me all that stuff too. So I had this wide variety of gaming experiences when I was young. That sort of informed my life because I've always seeked that stuff out to try to recreate those memories in my own life. And I've been really successful because I have, you know, a lot of opportunity to make those more and more and more of those memories now because this is my career now. I served some time in the military. After I got out of the military, I got a regular, a regular old job and was just a guy working and would play games whenever I had the opportunity. But back in 2004, my wife was pregnant with my son, and I had this idea in my head that I was going to try to recreate my own childhood through my son. You know, I was going to make him into a board gamer. And I started seeking out old games and stuff that I had remembered from my childhood, games like Broadsides and Boarding Parties or, you know, Der Schlacht der Dinosaur and all these old games. And I discovered HeroScape, and I got really enthusiastic about it. And some fan site popped up called HeroScape.net. Are you guys familiar with HeroScape?
Oh yeah,
oh yeah.
Yep. Okay, so absolutely. I'm just making sure. I became like one of the first members of a forum. This is back before social media. I became one of the first members of their forum there, and I actually got to meet Craig Van Ness and Rob Davio and the people, the creators behind the game. And my enthusiasm carried me along. I mentioned that I was buying a copy for all of my nephews and everything, and I was going to play the game with them, and I did, and they loved it. And I wrote a email to Craig Van Ness. I got his email. I wrote him an email talking about how much fun we had playing his game, and he invited me to be a playtester. And then from playtester, my enthusiasm carried me through to becoming a content developer, actually, for HeroScape, where they would just, you know, hire me on contract labor to create cards for the game. And then they spun HeroScape off to Wizards of the Coast, and I did the Dungeons & Dragons version of HeroScape. Mm-hmm. And I worked on that with a couple of other designers, Colby Dow being one of them.
Thank you for the money. I'm celebrating my 25th anniversary, so yes, I absolutely know HeroScape. So
so then after that was over, Colby, you know, my buddy and my boss and my friend and fellow co-conspirator or whatever, he spun off and started this company called Plaid Hat Games. And and he launched his company with a little game called Summoner Wars. And that like started to gain a measure of success. Again, this is back in the before the big board game explosion. So little guys had a you know, they had a real fighting chance at that time to make their mark on the industry. And he was he realized that he can be, to be a game company, you actually have to have games. You have, not just one game, you have to have more than one game if you want to continue the making games. And so he was asking around to see if anybody had any design ideas that they were working on and stuff. And he even asked me, and I told him no. Secretly, I was always tinkering around, but I just told him no. But shortly after that, a buddy of mine who was a sculptor, who's trying to break into sculpting miniatures, he was doing a little like an exercise for his mentor that where he would just go and ask people to give him an idea for a miniature and then he would sculpt it. I said, I was coming up with this idea for this this mouse game at the time. So I told him, hey, man, can you sculpt a little mouse warrior with a big axe and stuff? And about a week later, he showed up and he had this little warrior mouse sculpted. And he was really proud of it. And it turned out fantastic. In fact, I'll show it to you guys. It turned out fantastic. And then I took pictures of it and I started showing it around to my friends. And Colby got wind of it. And he was like, what's going on with that? And so I don't know if you guys can see this.
There he is. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so here's the little first mouse that was that really sparked the whole Mice and Mystics thing. See how cool he is?
That's awesome.
So anyways, so Colby got wind of that, and he was like, what's going on? And I was like, well, I've just been tinkering around with this little game to try to teach my daughter how to read, and it's a storybook game, you know, and it's got this little simple mechanics that kind of break up the reading to try to help her learn how to read. She was really struggling. And he's like, well, pitch it to me, man. And it was like 10 o'clock at night, just a random phone call. It's like 10 o'clock at night. Well, pitch it to me, man. So I was like, oh, okay. And so I kind of told him what I was working with. And I was like, and I want the currency in the game to be cheese, you know, and they do everything with cheese. And cheese does this and cheese does that. And he was like, ah, I want that game. I want to publish that game. And he's like, do you think you can have a prototype available to show me by Gen Con, which was about 6 months later? And so I just burnt the midnight oil for about 6 months trying to put together a playable prototype. And it's a lot harder, really, than you might think.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of work. I had to be disciplined. Every night I had to work on it. And I ended up with writing three whole chapters, the first three chapters of the game, and coming up with the mechanics and everything. I play tested it with a few friends, and I took it to Gen Con. And we had a big hotel room that year at Gen Con, and Colby had like cleared out the room and lined up, some people with knowledge in the industry. And so I was like nervous as heck when I was showing all these people, strangers to me in the room. I was showing off my game, but it went over really well. I mean, people were really talking about it because of some of the innovations for back then, some of the innovations that were in the game and just the way that it carried the theme forward. They really loved it. And so, that's basically how Mice and Mystics came about, and I've been working in the game industry ever since.
How does that creative process even work? I mean, okay, I want to design a game, great, but I suck at it, you know, or whatever. Like, you know, like you don't, right? I'm talking about me here, right? But how does that even, you know, okay, I sit down and work every night. Well, wonderful, but like, how does the imagination turn from the idea into the prototype?
Well, I mean, I'm not totally convinced that I'm any good at it either. honestly, I'm my own worst critic, I think I do some things well, but I don't have like some magic formula, and I don't have like the math skills or the art skills or the writing skills to do any of this stuff well. So I go on gut instinct, and I do a lot of play testing on my own to like try to make sure everything works. But I spend stupid amounts of time thinking about, you know, little game mechanics that can be used or leveraged for this or that, and how they would. And I learned a lot on HeroScape too, on how much you can do with a simple set of rules. You have to remember that I worked on HeroScape, basically milking that brand for as much as we could get out of it. Like writing abilities around that same set of mechanics and trying to get them to be unique and trying to get them to match the character. That's a really great skill. I mean, you can hone that skill. And so that's what I would recommend is anybody. I would recommend going back to what we used to do is tinker around. Tinker with other game systems. Make expansions, your own homebrew expansions for other game systems, or make house rules. I mean, don't feel like you can't. You own the game. You once you buy it, you own it. So mess with it.
Well, yeah, so you know what I'm saying. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really awesome because, you know, one of the things in terms of game design and stuff is that you'll see some games that go too far into the theme will have too many rules because they want to cover every single thematic possibility. So it's like, okay, well, if this happens, then it's got to be this. And if this happens, it's got to be this. And after a while, you have like, you know, a billion tokens and rules references that go on for paragraphs and paragraphs. So if you can find a way to condense that and, you know, again, bring it back to Stuffed Fables, because that's what I have the most experience with in your catalog of work. The way that, you know, you have special rules on the page, you know, the book format of that is wonderful. It just, so you can have special rules and it's not like, okay, I need to go back to the rule book and reference page 38, paragraph 5C. It's just right there in the margin.
It's true.
And
it's true.
And just, you know,
You can render a game unplayable by creating too many rules. I don't know if you've ever bought a game where you were really, I mean, the art was beautiful, the components were wonderful, the game was big and glorious and had all of this, you know, you had this expectation that this game was going to deliver on an awful lot, but there was a big problem and there was this big fat rule book. Mm-hmm. That you had to work your way through that big fat rule book, and you had to do the trial and error of making sure that you got all those rules right, and then you had to deal with frustrated fellow players as you're looking through the rule book because you forgot where this one obscure rule was and stuff. And as a designer, as a game designer, I feel like that's probably the biggest problem with Mice and Mystics is that there's too much of that rule book looking up. I would love to be able to create a game where you just didn't need the rule book at all. Once you read it, you just didn't need to look back on it. That was my attempt with Stuffed Fables, was to create a system where the actual system itself was so simple that you didn't have to look back on the rule book. You know the system. Now, any extra stuff that we add in, we don't send you to the rule book to get it. We put it on the page, or we give you a little environment card to slap it on there. If you only encounter water twice in the whole entire experience, why do you need to reference the rule book? We'll just give you a little card with that rule reference on there.
Yeah, and it works so smoothly.
And in fact, we don't even put it in the rule book. We don't thicken up the rule book with that stuff. Instead, we just have these little cards, and there's no reason to put it in the rule book. If you're only going to – if we give you the tools to reference it when you need it, then you don't need it in the rule book. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And everything from the condition cards and, you know, because – You could, if you really wanted to, go way off the deep end and, you know, have a stack of condition cards like, you know, 3 inches high or 6 inches high or whatever. And but I mean, it's a really good system, and I love to see that, and I love to hear, you know, the idea of designing under limitations, like those self-imposed limitations, and just saying, you know, all right, I have the freedom to do whatever I want, but, you know, that's not necessarily good design.
Yeah, you need to, and you know, you really need those boundaries. Actually, boundaries make you more creative. I think that they when you're unbounded, then it ruins your creative mind because you just are contemplating all the possibilities. But when you have this set of finite boundaries, then you're like, okay, I can work with this, okay, you know. And and then sometimes you come up to a brick wall where those mechanics don't stretch far enough for you, and you either get real creative with it and give it some good thinking time and discover a way to do it, or you have to expand on it somehow. But in my opinion, the rule book for any game should be very thin, and or all the games that I want to be involved in as a creator, I want nothing but like super thin rule books. And like my boss, Colby Dauk, he's the one that I really got this philosophy from. He he truly believes that rule books are a barrier. They're a barrier to more people entering our industry. Our games have bigger rule books than mass market games, and people buy mass market games 10 times more than they buy our games. And our games are better. So what's the deal? And the deal is, the big thing is it's that rule book. It's the barrier that keeps people from enjoying our game. So if we can make those thinner and make our rules more elegant, but make our games more robust in the experience, that's really what we're striving for. And I don't know, we'll never be, I'll never personally be happy with where we're at, but I think that it's a wonderful goal to strive towards.
Absolutely. And that keeps you moving forward too. I mean, not to encourage you to be dissatisfied, because you've made some incredible games, but that does help to have that drive to always be better and say, okay, we got this. How do we make that better? How do we get the next person to pick this game up? How do we get them into the hobby?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to do some of the things with board games that they do in other forms of medium. I picked up a video game app on my iPad the other day, and it was it didn't have any tutorial at all. The game just started, and it didn't tell you how to play at all. Nothing. It didn't tell you how to play. It didn't tell you one thing to do. It just started, and so I put my finger on the screen, and I saw my little guy move around a little bit. I moved my finger to the right, my little dude moved to the right. I moved my finger to the left, and my little dude moved to the left, and I nudged my finger up and he jumped, you know, I nudged my finger down and he crouched. And I thought to myself, God, I wish I could do that in board games. I wish I could make it so intuitive that people open up the box. There was no rule book. They open up the box. They started taking the components out and they all made sense. You know,
I really
would be awesome.
That'd be amazing.
That's one of my favorite games to play right now is the Arkham Horror LCG. From Fantasy Flight Games. Absolutely love the game. The setup and the time it takes for me and my friend to sit down at the table before we're actually playing the game and the time to put it away afterwards is nearly as long as our actual play experience. And the play experience is fantastic. But that's exactly what you're talking about. And we talk about that constantly. And I recommend that game a lot and I sell that game a lot, but that's the one thing I say to everybody that I sell it to. So...
Yeah, I mean, you know, they have people on Board Game Geek that like rate games by the amount of time it takes to set up, you know, and you can look and like some of them have like extremely long setup times. And I'm not, I mean, it is what it is. If you want this kind of experience that this game delivers, you're going to have to deal with that game setup time. I love Arkham Horror. I think it's just fantastic, fun experience, but, the setup time is crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, we deal with this in what you're talking about, video games compared to board games, something I don't think a lot about. I'm a total hybrid store, so I'm dealing with all the things that are going on in comic books right now, you know, and we make that digital to physical comparison all the time. The difference, like, digital comics are awesome. We love them, but comics are this inherently collectible thing, and that's the thing about a board game is the digital experience is great, but the board game experience provides something in a physical way, in an interactive way that the video game doesn't provide. They're different animals, you know? But I love if you make that game with no rule book, I will sell it for you, I promise.
Well, I think it's a great idea in your mind to like sit and think, okay, how could a person make a board game that didn't need a rule book?
Yep.
Like the closest thing I can come to is like Rory Story Cubes, where the rules were like a paragraph long. Like, I mean, have you seen like Rory Story Cubes?
Oh yeah. Yep.
The rules are like a paragraph long, and then there's just a bunch of these little dice, and then everything else is what you put into it. And you know, I just absolutely love that whole idea of like if I could have a paragraph that taught my people how to play the game, and then have the game gradually deliver everything and expand upon itself in its own organic way. I think that would be incredible.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that's very interesting, you know, bringing up and talking about is that barrier, you know, and a lot of times people will come up with the answers. Oh, it's, you know, people get intimidated. There's too many components or the price tag, you know, or whatever. But that idea that the rule book itself, you know, is a big barrier. That's really fascinating to me. And I love that idea. I mean, I'm just I know we've been kind of talking about it for a while here, but the idea of just, OK, here you go. You sit down and you play the game and it expands as you play it. You learn it as you go, and there isn't you know, hours spent poring over a rule book and all that. That's, if you ever design that, yeah, like Rich said, he'll sell it. I will play it. That is fantastic.
I think if somebody could do it, yeah, I mean, if it was me, that'd be great. But if somebody could do it, I think that it would be an instant hit. I think that it would be the kind of hit, if you were able to deliver a narrative experience or a big, you know, adventurous experience that left an indelible impact on people's memory, but it also was so easy to learn that you didn't really need a rule book. That would be a game that would transcend the two industries, the mass market industry and the regular board game industry.
Yeah, and we actually have a comment online that Love Letter is about as close to that as possible. And that's,
yeah, Love Letter, Rory Story Cubes, these things are really, really close. They're just very, very, very minimalistic on the rules, and I'm so enthused by that idea. We have a little thing about rule writing here at Plaid Hat Games, and I don't know how common this is, but and maybe it's more common than I know. But we don't believe that you need to write rules for things that are not allowed to be done in the game, like for things you can't do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, now, every
and,
so
and
often
the reason
you'll,
is yeah. because we know that rule books are a barrier to people. The more you add to a rule book, the less enjoyable the game experience is for people, especially, you know, being as inclusive as possible and trying to grow our market and create more gamers. If you have you can't just fill your rule book up with words and words and words about the stuff that the game that you're not allowed to do in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Only put in the rule book what you are allowed to do. And I know this sounds really weird, and people get frustrated with it sometimes. But and I get questions all the time, like in Stuff Fables, they're like, "Well, can I give this guy my buttons? I can't find it in the rule book anywhere." Because you can't do it.
Yeah, if you could, it would say so.
Give your buttons.
Yeah,
you earned those. Those are yours. Well, why can't I give them my buttons? Mm-hmm. Hey, dude, if you want to make up your own house rule and give them your buttons, that's totally cool with me. I have no problems with that. But we didn't put it in the rule book because it's not something you can do. We're only giving you the rules and the stuff you can do in the game. So why should we like tell you what you can't do? You also can't do, and I could list off a million things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so, you can't just declare yourself the winner and close the book. And
exactly.
I mean, I guess you could if you really wanted to. Like you said, it's your game, but then you don't play the game. So
yeah. So we're like adamant about it. We don't put stuff in our rules that you can't do. Now, when this meets people's expectations and it's out of joint with their expectations, then we have these situations where, well, mm-hmm. It doesn't tell me anywhere in the rule book. I've looked for 20 minutes and I can't find out how we're supposed to swap buttons. But you can't. So, you know, that's the thing where our philosophy about writing rules might not be universally accepted yet by everybody. But if mm-hmm. we want to get these rule books smaller, we can't just be filling them up with a bunch of crap that you can't do.
Right. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. actually a really good philosophy to take towards those rules. Because, yeah, you can easily bog down a rule book with the number of things you cannot do. And yes. So, yeah, I think that's actually a really smart way to go about doing that. And that's something I you know, honestly, reading through it, I didn't notice that. But when it came time to play, you know, when it was like, okay, can we trade stuff? It's like, no, it's not in the rule book, so I don't think we can. And it was,
well, yeah, and I mean, when I sat down to play, it was after Josh had played. And one thing that I talked about, so I have a new future stepdaughter, and I wanted to play this game, and I picked it up because I thought it'd be something we'd enjoy, right? But I know that she gets bored with any amount of rules really quickly, which she's a kid, she should, you know.
Yeah.
But so I asked Josh, like, Josh, how did you teach your kids? And you had, you know, the simplest answer ever.
Oh yeah,
right?
Basically, I sat down. It's a cooperative game, so you can play it solo if you want. So I just sat down and played all four of the characters and went through the first couple of pages of the story so that I made sure I understood the rules. And then when it came time to play, my kids didn't have to know anything other than draw dice out of the bag. If you get these, they go here. Otherwise, you can take them, you can roll them, and these are what the different colors do. Let's play, you know. And
yeah,
it was as simple as that. And it was God, it's so great. I don't want to spend the whole time just gushing over Stuffed Fables because, that's not necessarily what we're here to do. But it was such a great experience. And I'm just so impressed by all of the extra things thrown in there, like the questions at the end of the stories, to bring up and have discussions. So it's you're transcending just a simple board game with this. You know, it's going for that experience you're talking about, not just with the story aspect, but actually relating what happened in the game to life. And you can, these are like study questions you'd have at the end of a book, kids would have at school. And that's amazing. I can't believe, and maybe someone has thought of it before and I haven't seen it, but it's just such a great concept to include that so that, you're playing a fun game and you're having that family time, and that's wonderful. But then it's more than that. And so how did that come about? Was that all in your mind as you were going through and designing it? Or is that something that came along later where someone's like, I had this experience with my daughter and, it'd be but go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
Well, it was always the goal of the game was to have this experience with your friends and family. And then we consider board games. I don't know. I'm sure that a lot of board gamers out here have this same sort of feeling, or maybe it's just something that's just bubbling. But board games are basically the wonderful, holistic answer to the digital world. We are the polar opposite of the digital experience. We are people in person together, laughing and enjoying and experiencing each other's expressions. So if we are going to elevate our industry and elevate the wonderful hobby of board games, we need to own the fact that we have this hugely important role to play in the world right now of bringing people together. And why not take that and strum those strings as hard as we can to show what these things can do, what wonderful gift we have for the world. And I know I might sound dramatic right now, but this is the way I truly feel. Mm-hmm. So you get people sitting around the kitchen table. In my household, we have these decks of cards that we keep on the kitchen table. And when we have our weekly dinner at the table where we force our teenagers to put their cell phones down and stuff, and we sit around the dinner table, we pass this deck of cards around. And this deck of cards are questions that have, questions that you wouldn't normally ask your parent or your child, but get you talking about yourself in ways that will surprise you. And you'll be surprised by the answers you hear from your own children. These are people that I should know intimately, and yet I still am surprised by the answers that they give to these random off-the-wall questions about them. And those questions had such an impact on me and my family that I thought, wouldn't it be cool if my board game had a few of those that were also related to the experience that they just shared? And maybe that would enhance the impactfulness of it, right? So I knew I had to put those in there.
Well, that's excellent. When I saw that, honestly, I saw the game on the shelf and read a little bit about it. The theme of it, I knew. So my daughter isn't much of a gamer. My son will play games with me, all day long. She doesn't really get into it much. But I read about the theme of it and everything, and I knew instantly she would be completely into it. She loves it. It's a little bit of horror in there, but with the stuffed animals as guardians and all that great stuff. So I have to make sure I ask this because we are running out of time here, unfortunately. But I need to make sure on their behalf I ask: do you have plans for any kind of merchandise beyond the game with this? Because she would absolutely just inhale anything, like if you had books with stories in this universe, if you had stuffies, if you had little action figures, anything. Both my kids are just like, yeah, ask him, find out if he's going to do that. So I don't know if it's too early to tell. I don't know if anybody's obsessed with it as my kids are, but
the game's been out for 6 weeks now, four to 6 weeks now. I don't know if the sales figures are giving us indicators that it would support additional product, but oh man, wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and you probably have nothing to do with this whatsoever, but that's the thing for us is the price point on games, you know, like, and I don't know in the design phase, I don't know if that's ever a consideration or how much you're into that business, but you know, I had a mom in here and I was really excited. I just played the game the night before and she literally asked for like a story game and she was sort of asking about D&D, but then I asked about the ages of her kids and I said, well, here, play this, you know, and I know that it was the price sticker that kept her from buying it that day, you know, like guarantee it. So, I, you know, does that go into design at all, or is that a whole different animal than what you would ever deal with?
It's huge. It's
I just don't know how pervasive it goes down the company to the designers, you know, right? Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, I think that a company is, if they have faith in a product, they're more willing to, open the purse strings a little bit, I think, but they still have a formula that they need to stick to, and they still have guidelines. They can't just break those guidelines, you know, willy nilly. But, you know, obviously, volume of sales is going to help. So if they feel like they're going to sell a lot of copies, then you know that might affect the price. But really, I work for Asmodee. Now I may be with Plaid Hat Games, but we're a studio owned by Asmodee, and those people have the number crunching systems to figure all of this stuff out. And it's tough to be honest with you. It's tough. Stuffed Fables was really difficult because we wanted miniatures, but we also wanted this big fat book. And the big fat book is, as you know, is filled with, you know, tons of pages of unique art. And the book itself was an enormous expense to make. And so I kept other components quantity as low as I could. You notice there's only one thing of tokens, and I hate tokens anyways. If I could get rid of tokens, I would do that too, along with a rule book. But you know that, I mean, I can't stand games where you have to get this big organizing tray from the package store, and you have to like organize your tokens, and you're still looking for them, and you have to label your stuff. I can't stand all that. It's just too much. It feels like work, you know. So anyways, yeah, you know, like keeping the component as low as and as lean as possible so that we can take the things that really make the game shine and have those things stand out in the forefront. In this case, I mean, I know you guys have all seen the miniatures. They're just beautiful. And
they're wonderful. Yeah.
And just adorable. And nobody's ever done anything like this. I mean, they're stylized and they're silly, but they're also, you know, they have so much expression to them. You can literally tell the personality of the little characters by looking at their miniatures.
Yeah.
And they match the art so well, that kind of stuff. And it's all really expensive.
Yeah. But you know, and it depends
I don't think the margin on Stuffed Fables is probably as much as they might've wanted maybe, but we'll see what the sales figures look like, I think.
I mean, we sort of have our philosophies about price, but then those rules break. I mean, last year, I was the number one buyer of Clank from Southern Hobby in St. Louis, like almost 2-1. Like, they couldn't even, but literally, what are you doing? Like, are you, you know, are you giving them away? Like, what's happening up there, you know? And so just, and that's $60, you know? So just, it all depends on, like, the marriage, like, with stores in particular, it can be the who's coming in your store, what style of store you have as to, you know, which games are going to be that, or just the passion of the individual store owner. So, and I'm sure that's a big thing with you guys is, you know, trying to make personal connections and coming on podcasts, and because we all want the same thing, you know, we all want, I'm in this business because I love games and I love comics, not because I'm trying to be a millionaire, you know, so that's, there's nothing more satisfying than having somebody come back and say, you know, hey, that game you recommended, that was perfect. It was great. What do you got next? You know? So,
yeah. I mean, you know, trying to be as inclusive as possible is tough when you're up against, the cost to manufacture and the cottage industry woes of having only a certain amount of print run, you know, limitations on print run and stuff. So, but yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I'm the kind of person that, no podcast is too small for me to be on. Nobody is too insignificant to be sent a review copy of my games. I mean, I'm all about, like, you know, just trying to be with my people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I mean, that's like,
you guys are my kind of people.
I'm in a market where like Fargo has always outperformed. And I think like, I hope that it has something to do with me, you know, like when I like something, I sell the crap out of it. You know, I can sell 100 copies of a good game, even at $60, you know, and in Fargo, North Dakota,
send you some more stuff, Fables.
Yeah. Yes. Well, please do. You know,
like, we've restocked the shelves a few times.
I'll send you whatever I need, you know, to get, we would take anything. And like, and we're even going to reinvent that again. Because so 6 years ago, we were in the right place at the right time. We were ahead of the curve on board games, and we knew they were getting hot, whatever reason. We had just expanded and opened an event center, and I said, let's have tabletop night. And the first Saturday of every month, we had 150 to 200 people showing up. We had more people than chairs, you know? Yeah, I know, right? In Fargo, North Dakota, with our 200,000-person population. Josh was there. He'll tell you, you know? So,
can confirm.
Yeah. But
any portion of our country where people have to stay inside for long periods of time because the weather outside is like crappy.
Yeah, but now
sell the most board games.
Yeah, nice. But now 6 years later, like we have like 40 or 50 showing up, and I mean it's partially our own success because we preached community and friendship, so they all became friends and left. Like, you know, that's like but it's different now. Like, it was good enough in 2011 to just give them the chairs and tables, and it's not good enough anymore. And it's sort of the same thing you're talking about with the product. Is the experience of going to the local game shop. And and Josh and I and others, we're scratching our heads and trying to figure that out. And we know it's all changed. You know, we know there's 5 game shops now instead of 1. We know everybody plays at home, and we know they buy on board, you know, on Amazon. And we get all that, but we can still do better, you know. And that's what we always want too, is what do? We're here to try to change people's lives. We're here to affect people and try to reach somebody new and do something different and make it matter to them that they were at Paradox. We've always had this bizarre idea that like our shop is the right place to play because we do things in a certain way, whatever the hell that even means, you know. And but that's always been important, you know. And that passion has carried us. So I don't know. I don't know what comes next or what's happening or how to sell 100 copies of Stuff Fables, but I'll keep trying. So pardon my blather, but you know, I hope that made sense somewhere in there. So,
yeah, I've always, I've always done my best to support the local store owners. Some of my greatest gaming memories involve stores that I was a regular at. You know, in fact, I used to work next door to a game store. That's like a big part of the history of me. I literally worked in a strip center, and next door was a game store. So when I went on break. I went next door, and I mean, through all that, that's probably the only reason that I got involved in 40K and all those other games that were all popular at the time.
But you don't, and I mean this, I'm not a negative person. I'm actually extremely optimistic about where I'm going. But the thing is, you know, like the game shop, the local game shop, it's different now. You don't need us in any way that you used to need us. You have the internet. You have a way to buy stuff. You have a place to learn how to play it. And you have a place to learn how to recommend it, you know, without ever walking in a game shop. And that's what a generation of people, or now two generations of people, do. They don't need us. It's totally different. And that's just a, but on the other hand, there's more people doing this or nerdy, you know, there's more people in nerd culture than at any time, which means the opportunity to reach people is greater than it's ever been, even though it's harder than it's ever been.
I agree. It's definitely a challenge for you though. We have a local game store here called Madness. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it is enormous. They actually took over an old grocery store, like a big supermarket, and they filled that thing wall to wall with tables and games you would not believe. It's like enormous. And that place is just so busy, so crazy busy. You can't find a parking spot on the weekends. It's nutty.
Oh, wow.
I don't know what their secret is. I don't know how they do it. I mean, I see other game stores just, you know, open and then fold, and then this place is just wonderful.
Do you know who the owner of that store is?
No, I don't.
No, I know a couple Texas
and
guys.
They don't even know. I'll go in there and, you know,
they don't know who you are.
I don't try to play like I'm some sort of, you know, know-it-all or, you know, game person. I just go in there just to be a consumer, you know.
All right, we better ask our last couple of questions. So I've always wanted to write my first novel, which, you know, I'm 48, so we'll see if that ever happens. But how cool is it to walk in and see your name on a box or you know watch somebody buy the game you designed? Like, how satisfying is that?
If I walk into a game store and my game's, like, sitting there on the shelf, you know, and everything, I'm like, why in the heck are they sold out?
That's the correct answer.
It's actually pretty surreal. It's very surreal. I'm just being silly. It is. It's a very surreal thing when you see, like Plat Hat, we have a tendency to put our game designers' names right on the box, which is, I mean, we're one of the few companies that actually do that, you know, and other companies have actually, you know, kind of followed our lead on that. And the reason that we do that is because we know the people that work for Hasbro, and we know how Hasbro refused to give them any sort of credit for the work that they did. And so we wanted to make sure that we were the opposite of that. And it's a really intimidating but really, really cool experience.
Yeah, so it's humbling. There is a game designer for Fantasy Flight. So works for the same company you do. But his name is Alex Davey, and Star Wars Legion released today. And on the front of the box of Star Wars Legion, it says designed by Alex Davey. So here's my story. Alex Davey grew up in Fargo, North Dakota at Paradox Comics and Cards. And I kicked this kid out of Star Wars CCG tournaments in 1998, you know, when he was 10 years old. Like, I helped teach him how to play Pokemon. Like, the reason he's a gamer is because of me and my shop. And that's not so fair. Cool. It's because of himself, you know. But, I mean, we created that experience for him and grew up or whatever. So we had him on a podcast 2 weeks ago on Skype, and we unboxed Legion with him. And, I mean, it was just awesome. It was awesome, you know. And I just – I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. So, anyway, thank you so much for joining us. And, Josh, you get last question time.
No, I think all I want to say here at the end, because there's so many things we talked about, you know, we touched on, like, right at the beginning there especially, that I would love to go into more detail. So we'll probably try to get you back on sometime. I'll hound you.
Have me back on.
Yes, we've absolutely.
You guys are great.
Perfect. It's on tape. We've got it recorded. You can't go back on it.
Sorry, I was late.
No, that's okay. No problem. We were running a little behind too, so it ended up working out perfectly.
What are you working on now?
Game.
Yeah. Ooh, we're looking forward to that one.
I love a game.
I love a game.
Adventure book game.
Cool.
Awesome.
Not intended for children, but.
Oh.
Do you have you ever heard of Extra Life?
Yes.
So we're a huge Extra Life store. We helped raise $35,000 each of the last 2 years. And Josh heads our stream. So that'd be one thing we'd love to get. You know, we struggle to get 20 people to watch our stream, and we'd really like to work on that. So maybe we can come back to you later in the year and see if we can get you involved a little bit. So
sure, I'd love to help out anyway.
But I need to make sure I mention, because my wife let my kids stay up late to watch this. And my son just wanted to say they like Stuff Fables because it has a good storyline, the characters are creative, and also cute, is what my daughter said, and it's a fun cooperative game that takes family time. So you've made an impact on a couple of kids there, and I hope that more people have had a similar experience or are encouraged to have that experience because of our conversation tonight. So thank you again so much. Absolutely.
Very kind. Thank you.
No, we love having you on, and like I said, we will definitely be in contact in the future, and looking forward to what you come out with next. So,
absolutely.
Awesome. Right. Thank you.
You bet. And thanks to everybody who joined us in the chat live here, and everybody who is listening later on the DocsCast. We appreciate each and every one of you as well. And I guess Jerry, is there anything that you want to plug in terms of ways to get in touch with you, where to find you on the internet, or anything like that? Or
sure, you can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is mice_guy, and that's probably the best thing right there. I do my Twitter.
Perfect.
Awesome.
You can go to our website. It's plathatgames.com. My contact information is on there. So anybody who wants to email me or anything, my email's just right there. So if you ever have any questions or or just you just want to interact with me, I'm totally approachable. So.
Yes, and I've seen that you've responded pretty. You watched the forums over on Board Game Geek and stuff like that. You've been pretty active over there, helping with questions and things.
I try to do that. Yes, but I also think that there's a good reason to like sort of let Board Game Geek, you know, create a life of its own around a game. You know, I don't think that they want the designers like haunting the place too much, you know, and it allows people to be more honest and open with their opinions of the game and stuff. So they don't want to do that if the designer's like hovering around all the time.
That's true. Yeah.
So I stop by every once in a while and chime in on stuff, but I try not to hover too much. You can just get too obsessive with your own games out there when they go out in the world. And why? There's nothing you can do about them once they're released. So.
Right. If you're not going to make the rule book too big, then you don't need to make the forums too big either.
I know from my end, I put my heart in everything I do. I put my heart in everything. And so I can't ask any more of myself than just being true to myself and trying to make the best thing I can. And then once it's out there, then it's up to the world to decide whether it's something that they find value in or not.
That's well said, and I think that's a good note to end on. So thanks again, Jerry, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you on the next DoxCast.
Thank you.
This was a DoxCast. Hope you think it rocks, cast. Oh, look at the clocks, cast. Until next time, geek on.